It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm J. Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Starting today, public universities in Florida have to assess so-called viewpoint diversity on their campuses to prevent them from being too one-sided politically. We'll dive into how it works and what it means for higher education coming up.
First, even with all the advances in smartphone features, one older technology has stood the test of time: texting.
The actual process has gotten easier over time. For example, you don't have to punch numbers repeatedly on a flip phone, but the basic concept has basically remained unchanged.
Texting is the single most used feature on smartphones, and it's widely used by people of all generations. And our next guest says it has a big impact on our relationships in and out of a pandemic.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think texting has made a positive impact on your relationship with a friend, a family member, or a partner? Do you like being able to share thoughts instantly? Would you prefer someone's full attention over a phone call instead? Do you think we text too much instead of using other forms of communication? We want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Catalina Toma is a professor in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. She's an expert on the social and psychological effects of communication technologies, including text messaging. Catalina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So, Catalina, how do you think texting behaviors have changed over, say, the last 10 years?
I would say the biggest change in texting behavior has been its increase, sheer numbers. Texting has become tremendously popular in the maintenance of all sorts of relationships, from friendships to communication with family members to romantic relationships, and to some extent in our professional lives as well. So we're seeing a real surge in numbers in the use of texting, like you all mentioned in the beginning.
And why do you think we have seen such an increase in texting? It could be just as easy to dial a number and call someone over the phone. It might be faster to get the information you need. So why do you think texting has really exploded?
That's a really interesting question and a really interesting comparison with the phone or to face-to-face communication. When we do research on the topic, we like to think of the features and affordances of various media and how they change the communication patterns. And with texting, one really important feature is that it's not intrusive. You're able to communicate with people at low effort through just verbal means, right? You're just texting words, writing down words, without necessarily interrupting their current activities. And that's a big plus if you're trying to convey mundane information as you're going through life, as you're moving through your day. That's really important. Texting is also portable, right? It's done on smartphones that we carry with us at all times. So it's very easy to access. There's low barriers to access, and it's really low effort in composing those messages. So research, really fascinating research shows, for example, that people tend to resort to the phone, which used to be very popular decades ago, when they have big and usually negative, important news to share. So we refer to this phenomenon as phone fears. People are worried when the phone rings because it's usually something bad, and that is correct. So we feel justified in interrupting people's days with a phone call when something important happens. But for more mundane, casual communication, texting feels a lot more polite, frankly.
Yeah, I feel like I'm probably not the only one that feels this way. But when my phone rings, I sometimes do feel annoyed. And so one of the things I'm also curious about is texting in the broader scope of communication is pretty new. But in terms of in technological communication, it's pretty standard at this point. I remember learning how to text on T9. So that was when you were pounding the numbers to get to the number, get to the letter that you wanted. And it seems like smartphones have made that easier. But how do, say, different generations approach texting, especially now with smartphones?
That's a really interesting question. And I'm an old user myself. So I remember times when I didn't have a cell phone and I didn't know how to text, and I didn't even know how to type for that matter. So it's a really interesting time in history now, because we have generations who have completely 100% grown up with these technologies, what we call the digital natives. And we have people like myself and older people who absolutely did not and had to learn it from scratch. So consistent with that, we are actually seeing differences in the pattern of adoption of these technologies and the amount of reliance people have on these technologies. And they're exactly what you would have expected, right? If you've grown up with it, you're going to use it a tremendous amount. We're seeing increased use with the older generations, but they're not near as frequent users of the technologies as the younger ones.
We are talking to Catalina Toma right now. She is a professor in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, and we're talking about how texting impacts relationships, especially during COVID-19, the pandemic, when people started relying a little bit more on these lifelines to reach out to friends, family, and texting was one way that people did it. So, you know, Catalina, you were saying a minute ago that texting is kind of the more mundane, more polite way that people might think about interrupting someone during their day. And, you know, texting is a tool of, communication, but it doesn't always have to be mundane. How can texting also be, you know, fun and playful?
Well, mundane actually includes fun and playful. So when we talk about mundane talk in relationship science, this is actually a tremendously important relationship maintenance strategy. So when we're maintaining our relationship, we don't just do the big things like having the talks or going on trips or doing important things together. Actually, the lifeline of relationships is everyday communication, the mundane talk, the everyday sharing that I was talking about earlier. And this can be fun and playful. Actually, positivity is one way to maintain relationships, just sharing jokes or sharing something funny or interesting that has happened to you during the day. Providing little messages of assurances. This is really important in romantic relationships. The little I love you, the little I'm thinking about you. Those things are tremendously important. And we're seeing, as we might expect, a great amount of use of texting for mundane talk or everyday sharing. This being said, texting also happens for more important conversations. So one area of research that I'm fascinated by and that I wish there was more research available currently is the use of technologies for relationship conflict. You know, what happens when we resort to these technologies for engaging in conflict? And conflict can be really disruptive to a relationship and or can be really important in the survival or growth of the relationship. And there is some evidence that people do use texting and other communication technologies for conflict, but it's not yet clear if it's a good thing or a bad thing. People perceive both advantages and disadvantages of these technologies.
So I want to take a caller right now. We have True in Madison who joins us to talk about how they use texting for their day-to-day lives.
Hey, this is True.
And what did you want to say, True?
I just wanted to, first of all, bring up, I use texting a lot, group texting, when I'm trying to make plans with my friends. I'm a 27-year-old. But sometimes it seems like group texts really, like, get the job done, and sometimes it seems like it almost irritates the people that are a part of it. And I was wondering if there's kind of any research for how to send the most effective group text.
Thanks for that call, True. What do you think? What's the most effective way to include a lot of people in one messaging system?
That's a really interesting point, True. Thank you for bringing up groups. There is some research showing that people are using groups increasingly with certain texting applications, and especially during COVID. They are great for efficiency, for sending the same message to a larger number of people and reaching them in this way. And they're great for mundane relationship maintenance. So think about the friends that we have and sending them memes or sending them jokes and having some of them respond and maybe some nod depending on their schedule and their availability. So for those things, group texting is great. But for what True talked about, coordination of actual activities of meetings, it could be trickier. And a lot of it has to do with the size of the group. Obviously, the more people involved, the more difficult it will be to make plans. And because texting tends to be sequential and take a little bit longer than face-to-face communication, making those plans and achieving that coordination can be delayed with texting than having the discussion face-to-face. So it's a little bit less efficient in a situation of having more people, as I'm sure we've noticed personally.
And, you know, in that vein, you know, one of the things about group texts are some people don't respond, some people do. And that's one of the things that, depending on where you stand on this, texting can be nice. You can reply in your own time, but you also might leave someone hanging. Can you talk about maybe the pros and cons that you see in these real situations where there's a mismatch in expectation and actual texting back?
Sure. I think the biggest problem that is recorded by research with respect to texting concerns something that we call response latencies. This refers to the amount of time that it takes for us to get a response to our text. People have expectations about what's an acceptable response latency and what is not. And this is an area where people can get really upset and relationships can get very fraught. When we don't receive the responses in what we consider to be a good amount of time. So this is an area where we have to be mindful not to leave partners hanging, to respond in a timely manner. There's this question of what is a good texter? What makes a good texter? And a big part of it is somebody who engages with you rapidly. And I think expectations for getting back to people immediately have increased over time. And a conversation that goes well over texting is a conversation that tends to be more synchronous than asynchronous.
We are talking about texting right now and how it can impact your relationships. And I want to pick up on that latency and how conflict can arise in just a moment. Our guest is Catalina Toma. She's a professor in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How does texting affect your relationships? Do you remember a time before texting? Do you like things better now that you have the option to just send a quick note? Does it get in the way sometimes when somebody ghosts you on texting and you're waiting and waiting to hear back? Does texting boost your romantic communications with people, your family communications, your friend setting up stuff arrangements? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we are picking up our conversation with Catalina Toma. She's a professor in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. And we're talking about the ways that text messaging impacts our relationships.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you look at texting as convenient, fun, annoying, a chore, a little bit of all of the above? How does texting affect your life? How do you use it in your relationships? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Now, Catalina, before we went to break, one of the things that we were talking about was sometimes the mismatch between, you know, when people respond quickly and when people don't. And one thing that I've been thinking about is, you know, how texting and text-based communication can really set the stage for romantic relationships. A lot of people are meeting online via an app. And the first way you basically start courting, to use kind of an old-fashioned term, is through texting. Can you talk about how that plays a role in early and then more mature romance?
That's right. So texting is becoming really important in the initiation stage of relationships, concurrent with the popularity of online dating. So online dating is an absolute huge player in the world of romantic relationships these days. One study that came out in 2019 is showing that online dating has become the most popular way for people to start relationships these days, displacing meeting through friends, which used to be the most popular way before. So what happens on these sites is you get connected to potential partners or matches, and then you're able to start text-based communications with them. And that's the typical first contact that people have with a potential partner. Then there's variability in the amount of time that people spend texting and what it is that they text about. Some people prefer to meet face-to-face immediately. Other people tend to delay that initial meeting and spend more time texting. And one area of research here that I think is absolutely fascinating is this question of what's the ideal amount of time that you want to spend texting with somebody before meeting face to face? Or is there a non-ideal amount of time that you can spend online? And there's some research providing some answers. And the answer basically is that texting is good for connecting initially and for disclosing, but it is possible to text too much before meeting in person. About 7 days or so is when things become too much. If you spend more than that amount of time on average, again, these are all averages, texting with a potential romantic partner, what can happen is that you can develop an overly beautified and impressive version in your mind of your partner that departs from reality, such that when you eventually meet face to face, you're going to be disillusioned and disappointed, and that's going to get in the way of relationship development. And the reason that happens is because, well, when we text, we have more control over message composition. We can control what we say. We can edit what we say more carefully than if we had to meet in person in real time without the ability to take back undesirable things that we say. So people tend to engage in this selective self-presentation. They're really careful about what they say when they're interested in impressing somebody, as is the case with online dating. That's one phenomenon that happens here. The other is over-attribution, or the idea that when we have limited information about somebody, we tend to mentally fill in the blanks with information that makes sense to us. So if we're just seeing positive things, we're imagining that the person is even greater than maybe we would have thought face-to-face when we had more information. So the more time you spend online, the more you project, and the more likely you are to be a little bit disappointed when you eventually meet face-to-face.
That's really interesting to think of that early texting, that there is a limit. Otherwise, you could come across more clever in your texts. Your potential romantic partner could as well, and there could be some disappointment somewhere in between. I want to take a call really quickly. We have Lisa in Madison.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa. What do you want to say?
I was just earlier you had mentioned how when there's conflict in the relationship, how texting for my significant other and I, when we're having a lot of conflict and we're not communicating the best, sometimes texting gets our point across and we're able to communicate better than face-to-face. 'Cause when we text, you know, when we talk face-to-face, it can be an argument. When texting, it seems to be absorbed better for some reason.
So, Lisa, thank you for that call. And, you know, we did very briefly touch on conflict sometimes getting exacerbated by text, but it sounds like, Lisa, it gives maybe a little bit of a cooling off period. Are we seeing that at all with some conflict? Is it maybe the exception, or is it make it a little bit more nuanced?
I think Lisa is a very astute observer here. She makes some really fantastic points. There's been studies asking people what they think are the advantages of having a conflict over texting or communication technologies in general. And some of the things that Lisa mentioned come out really strongly. For instance, there's this idea of more careful message composition that I've already mentioned. So you can take as much time as you want to put down your thoughts. You can edit them to make sure that they're just right, that maybe they're not overly emotional, that maybe they're not hurtful to your partner, that you're communicating what it is that you want to communicate. That's a big advantage. Another advantage is reduced interruptions. In some people's communication dynamics, there's a lot of cutting off. and one partner isn't able to get their point across because the other keeps interrupting, maybe one is more verbal and more skilled than the other. And the person who isn't so skilled can't quite get their point across. And that can be minimized through texting. Another advantage is reduced flooding. Flooding refers to the experience of being overwhelmed by emotion. Some people get very emotional during conflict. It's very aversive to them, or to us, I should say. It's really unpleasant. And we can become really emotional in a way that can be alleviated by texting because there's more distance with texting or technologies in general. So all of these are advantages that people mention when you ask them, what do you think is good about technology when engaging in conflict?
Do you think that there is any point in, I mean, to make the argument that, hey, maybe put down the texting, maybe put down the phone if you are engaged in conflict, even if maybe you are a little bit better on the typing things out front?
Yeah, that's such a great point. So I mentioned advantages. There's also perceived disadvantages. Some people do not like having conflict over texting. And here's some of the things that they say. One is the issue of waiting time or response latency that I've mentioned earlier. When you're engaged in a fraught discussion in a conflictual situation and you have to wait for your partner to respond, that can feel especially torturous because you're projecting all sorts of negative things in your mind, right? Why aren't they getting back to me? Am I not important enough? What's going on there? And people are not completely wrong about that. Research shows that people are more likely to purposefully delay responding over text than they are face-to-face. Other people feel an emotional disconnect with their partner when they're just texting about the conflict. They feel like the embodied self is really important for conveying emotion, you know, for maybe having a hug or a pat on the back or all of these displays of emotion, or just reading your partner's emotion from their face. So these folks really prefer face-to-face communication for that reason. Now, so you would wonder, what's more important? Is it the advantages or the disadvantages? There's been a couple of studies on this topic. In these studies, researchers bring participants to the lab and they manipulate the media through which they have conflict. So the participants are told to talk about a contentious issue in their relationship, and half of them do so face to face and the other half do so through texting or instant messenger, which are very similar, identical in this case. I will say that in these studies, research shows a net benefit for face-to-face communication. So people feel like they've resolved the conflict a little bit better. They feel more finality. They feel more positive emotions when they have dealt with the issue face-to-face. But again, these are just a couple of studies, and we need to do more comprehensive research about individual differences. Are there maybe some people who benefit from technology more than others? For some people who dislike technology more than other. We also need to do research on spontaneous conflicts, on naturally occurring conflicts rather than the ones that are prompted in the lab.
So we will absolutely need to have you back on to talk about that. Thank you so much, Catalina.
I would love to be back. Thank you.
Catalina Toma is professor in the Department of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about texting. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on the morning show, as more people head outside for a holiday weekend, we hear from a professor who studies mosquitoes, ticks, and other pests. That's tomorrow morning at 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, a new law takes effect in Florida today. Supporters say the goal is to make political thought on college campuses more diverse.
Under the plan, public universities will have to assess so-called viewpoint diversity through a survey developed by the State Board of Education. The schools are supposed to hand it out to students and faculty each year.
Here's Florida Governor Ron DeSantis at a news conference just before signing that legislation.
We obviously want our universities to be focused on critical thinking, academic rigor. We do not want them as basically hotbeds for stale ideology. That's not worth tax dollars, and that's not something that we're going to be supporting going forward.
It's not entirely clear how this is going to work. The law doesn't address penalties for schools if the surveys come back one-sided. Plus, our next guest says while the state can require universities to pass out the survey, they can't force students to take it.
Critics of the measure say it opens the door to political manipulation and could actually stifle intellectual and academic freedom.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about forcing colleges to survey students and faculty's political beliefs? Is this a good way to ensure diversity of thought, or do you think it will have the opposite effect? If you're a student or if you teach on a college campus, what do you think of the move? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org.
Clay Calvert is a law professor and the Breckner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication and director of the Marion B. Breckner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida. Clay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
You've got front row seats there, Clay. Can you tell us how this legislation came about?
Sure. Well, I think it came about because Florida is, as you know, a large red state with a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. And I think there's a large perception out many of the public, particularly among conservatives, that higher education leans to the left, is politically biased toward Democrat views. And so, in other words, I think this law has a large political motivation to it. And even we could go so far as to say positioning Governor DeSantis for a possible run for president of the United States in 2024.
Do we know what kind of things, what kind of questions might end up on this survey?
We do not, actually. The Board of Governors has been asked, and that's what's in charge of the universities here in Florida, the public universities, to select and create an objective, nonpartisan, and statistically valid survey to be used by the state's universities. So we don't have the survey yet, but we are going to have it fairly fast because the first data are to be collected in 2022. So it's coming up next year. And as you said earlier, it takes effect today. So they're going to have to crank out something that's valid very soon. We don't know what it'll look like then.
Statistically valid. And this will be issued, I guess, this survey to all students, but will they all respond?
That's the thing. You can mandate that state universities, including the University of Florida, where I am, Florida State, University of Central Florida, et cetera, conduct these surveys, but you cannot mandate that students, staff, and faculty fill them out. So one of the problems here is really bias in terms of who actually goes ahead and completes the survey. As you know, students are asked to complete surveys all the time. I suspect that the 80% of students who really feel one way or the other don't really care very much, they're doing fine, are simply going to say, I'm not going to fill out another survey. What's the point of this? So the students then who would be more biased to take it would be those who feel aggrieved in some way. And that, of course, might skew the results in a way that is really not statistically valid.
The law, as I understand it, Clay, doesn't say if the survey turns out in such a way your funding gets cut. But we just heard the governor say it's not worth tax dollars. It's not something they're going to be supporting going forward if they don't like the answers here. What do we know about how this is going to be used when it comes to dollars?
See, we really don't. And that's the big fear, though, I think, among many people in academia at public universities in the state of Florida, is that this could be used as a weapon to withhold funding when the state issues its annual appropriations to public universities. That if in the legislative body's mind or the governor's mind, somehow a university's data skew one way, so let's say to the left, then funding might be withheld. So this could be something that would be used to hold over the heads of universities whose data doesn't satisfy lawmakers in Tallahassee here, which is the capital. And then they would say, well, until you do a better job of promoting, and the terms are intellectual freedom and viewpoint diversity, those are the terms of the law, on campus, then we're going to reduce your funding by X amount. So it could be used as a weapon, because otherwise, what's the purpose of gathering the data? If it's simply benign and informational to help universities out, then that's no problem. If it's benign to say, well, parents have an interest in knowing what the university does, then that's fine. But I think many people perceive that this is a dangerous kind of, camel's nose here under the tent of censorship coming down the line.
Talking to Clay Calvert, law professor at the University of Florida, talking about a new law in Florida requiring universities, public universities, to survey their students on ideological perspectives. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I can't think of anything more chilling since the McCarthy era. We don't have a conservative GOP anymore. We have basically an extremist fringe party that is now trying to survey our own political views without even having any idea what they will be used for and what the penalties might be down the road. Republicans are always talking about the slippery slope, and this is the slipperiest slope I've ever seen when it comes to fascism and totalitarianism.
Tom, thanks for calling in. Clay, as I understand it, though, if I'm a student at the University of Florida, which I'm not, but if I were, I fill out this survey. It's not attached to me, right? It's an anonymous response to the survey. Do I have that right?
Right. That would be correct. And again, as a student, staff or faculty, you don't have to fill it out. But I think the caller was right about the potential chilling effect in the classroom. I believe that certain professors who do teach about controversial subjects, let's say it's immigration, healthcare, abortion, whatever the critical race theory, whatever it might be, might stay away from certain subjects or viewpoints for fear that a student out there who's listening to the lecture will take that discussion of the viewpoint as an actual endorsement of the viewpoint and therefore use that against that professor. So while it's intended to promote a diverse marketplace of ideas, it could actually backfire and chill speech by making professors more timid regarding discussion of controversial ideas for fear that students will perceive that as an endorsement of those ideas rather than a discussion or debate about them.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Jeff now in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Good afternoon. I actually applaud the efforts of the governor of Florida. I think this is an excellent idea to codify a value that we share as Americans. I think it will help teach us to listen to one another, even if we disagree. I'm a graduate of the University of Notre Dame. We had a diversity policy throughout my 4 years I went to school there. The past three or four presidents of the university always invited the president of the United States to come speak because, you know, whatever the political party, he's still the president of the United States, and that's what leadership's all about. And people who come to campus, public speakers who even disagreed with Catholic Church teaching were welcome. And we were mature adults. We listened and we made our decisions and discussed it in seminar. It was very stimulating, and I think it's good for Americans to be thinkers.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. And Clay, Jeff hits on one of the areas that people focus on a lot when they talk about intellectual diversity on campuses, the guest speakers, who is invited to speak, who gets a platform there. Do you have thoughts on what Jeff had to say?
Sure. And as a public university, which the University of Florida is, we must, as a governmental entity, follow the First Amendment. We cannot discriminate against speakers based upon their viewpoint when they come to campus. So we had, for instance, when Trump was running for re-election, and in 2019, Donald Trump Jr. And Kimberly Guilfoyle came to campus. They were speaking on campus. And what happened was exactly what should happen. They were allowed to speak. There were protests outside. You had a great example of counter speech in the marketplace of ideas, where both Trump Jr. and Guilfoyle got to espouse their views. Those who protested them got to do that. More controversially, at the University of Florida in 2017, we had to host white nationalist Richard Spencer on campus. Once a public university creates auditoria for speech events, it cannot discriminate against speakers based upon their viewpoints. So in Richard Spencer, and this was shortly after Charlottesville, Virginia, that summer of 2017, decided to come to the University of Florida. As a governmental entity, the University of Florida could not say, well, we don't like your viewpoint. We're not going to allow you on campus. So I do think that there are conservative speakers and even extremist speakers who are allowed to come to university campuses. And that's what a marketplace of ideas should be. We already must follow the terms of the First Amendment. And this bill, I should also note, has a provision in it that says that state universities cannot, quote, shield, unquote, students, staff, and faculty from views that make them feel uncomfortable, unwelcome, and disagreeable. But we already have to do that under the terms of the First Amendment.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We're talking about a new law in Florida and one in Indiana as well, by the way, that survey campuses on issues related to politically diverse thought. Clay Calvert is our guest. He's a law professor and director of the Marion B. Breckner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about requiring public universities to survey students about their political beliefs? Do you think it's good or a bad idea? Would you like to see Wisconsin pass similar legislation? Do you worry about indoctrination on college campuses, or is that not a real threat? And if you're a student or faculty member, what have your experiences been like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can email ideas at WPR.org.
The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We are talking about so-called viewpoint diversity on college campuses. A new law takes effect in Florida today that requires public universities to hand out surveys created by the state to students and faculty about their beliefs. The law doesn't specify how the results will be used. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says the idea here is to prevent state schools from becoming, as he says, hotbeds for stale ideology. Similar legislation was signed into law in Indiana in May.
Our guest is Clay Calvert. He's professor of law and the Brechner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication and director of the Marion B. Brechner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida. And let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Fred in Stanley. Fred, hi.
Hi. I guess I was just thinking more of it, you know, from the political social environment we're in and the way that a lot of athletes are responding to what's happening in the world. Would this type of law, if I know you said it'd be anonymous, but if they were to survey an athletic team and they came out leaning to the left side, would they, you know, if it gets tied to funding, are they going to start cutting sports programs and stuff like that as well?
Fred, thanks for the call. Clay, I don't think sports are a big deal, college sports in Florida, right? No, I'm kidding, but would this have an effect on athletics there?
I don't believe it is. I mean, the other interesting thing, obviously the Supreme Court just ruled on the college athletes and how they can essentially get paid. That's a whole other issue, can of worms from this one. This isn't tied to that, but certainly, again, one of the big picture issues is the threat that funding could be withheld. And again, one of the things we don't know is what part of the data, how much would a survey have to show? 15%, 25%, 30% think it's biased. In other words, we don't know what that figure would be enough to push the legislature to say, okay, we're going to withhold your funding if they do. But certainly that's the fear I think that many people here are living under. But it would be anonymous. And again, students don't have to fill it out. But that's an interesting theory were that to be part of it. But it's not right now, athletics.
Fred, thanks for the call. Let's go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hello.
Hey, so I'm a political science and history double major from UW-Milwaukee. I have 24 or 42 credits towards a master's of public administration. I feel that on any campus, it should be opened up and let the discussion take place, no matter how distasteful an idea may be, as long as it doesn't, you know, threaten the president or yell fire in a crowded theater. I think we should allow all viewpoints to be discussed, because if your point is so correct, you should be able to explain to me without calling me out of my name, without going to talking points, without swearing at me. You should be able to explain to me where the error in my logic is if yours is so correct. And as my grandpa, when he was alive, he used to tell me, Rob, he said, look, if you can't not raise your voice to the other person, then clearly there's something wrong with your own viewpoint, because if yours is so correct, you should be able to hear about all ways and become more in accord with your own. And I say let the chips fall where they may. And if it's so distasteful, if it's so incorrect, then DeSantis should show them this is where the error is.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Clay, what do you think?
Sure. Well, the United States Supreme Court, I think what the caller is really tapping into is a good point. The United States Supreme Court has made it clear that public universities, their classrooms and the surrounding environs are indeed quintessential marketplaces of ideas. All ideas in a public university should be allowed to come out, even if they're offensive or disagreeable, and they should be rationally debated, as the caller was suggesting, and rationally discussed, you know, not using epithets or name-calling or ad hominem attacks. But that really is the purpose of a public university, besides generation of knowledge and passing along knowledge. It's to have debates and discussion to make students think critically. And I believe that most professors really do try hard to strike a good balance and show both sides of the issues. I think probably in some colleges, more the liberal artsy side, it may be that the faculty maybe is more Democrat than they are Republican. That might be true. But probably in colleges of businesses, it might swing the other direction. But I think professors in both of those types of colleges would try to do their level best to expose all students to all sides of the issues. So again, the caller's point, I think, was the marketplace of ideas. And that's a great theory that underlies much of our First Amendment rationales in the United States. We only stop very few forms of expression, those that the court has said are not protected, the Supreme Court has said are not protected, such as obscenity, child pornography, fighting words, incitement to violence and true threats. Certain categories like that are not protected, but otherwise, even if your viewpoint's controversial, and that certainly was Richard Spencer, he wants a, you know, white nationalist state, it's a political view, and you got to be able to debate it, and you got to be able to challenge him. You can't just say, well, we don't like your view, you can't come to campus, because who's the next person you're going to say that to down the line?
Thanks for the call, Marcus. One argument, Clay, has been that, okay, if you're in a classroom and people are expressing the point that, say, a racial group or a gender group or whatever is inherently inferior to everyone else, is that creating an environment where the subjects of that conversation are facing a hostile learning environment? And I think that's been the case made for a lot of limits on, I guess, the full wide open argument. What do you think of that approach?
No, I agree with that. So we think about in the workplace, right, sexual harassment. We have a hostile working environment, you know, where if a boss or supervisor makes certain comments over and over again, that creates a hostile work environment. The same thing could obviously happen in an educational environment, creating an atmosphere where students, minority students perhaps, whether it's minority based upon their race, religion, or even viewpoint, feel uncomfortable talking, and that therefore stifles their ability to receive a full education. So it's really, I think, incumbent on professors to make sure that that doesn't happen. Certainly, some students are going to hold views that are very controversial, and I think they should be allowed to express those views, the substantive ideas of them, but not using particular epithets or name-calling in the process of doing so. And then the professors and other students should be able to debate those ideas, and if they want to attack them, they should, because that's the marketplace of ideas. But when I say attack, I don't mean, you know, vicious verbal attacks, but debate them fairly and rationally. That's the marketplace of ideas, to go back to that concept.
Talking to Clay Calvert from the University of Florida Law School, and we are talking about a new law in Florida that requires public universities to do surveys of students, faculty, and more, looking at ideological viewpoints. Back to your calls now. Max is with us in Appleton. Max, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I go to the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, and I have met so many different people, and everybody seems to kind of have their own unique political takes, and nobody ever was really just like in one or two categories, and it felt like everything was diverse, and I mean diverse enough politically where there were clubs for almost any sort of political ideology you could have. And I don't think there's any harm in surveys like this happening, because then at least the faculty and the people who run the colleges then are able to kind of, you know, get a feel for how their students lean one way or another. Obviously, it's anonymous, but if you look at like percentages and stuff, and, you know, maybe they'd be thinking of certain classes, and maybe they're thinking they'd want like more liberal classes or something, but then they realize, oh, like this college has a higher percentage of conservatives or vice versa. Then they could tailor classes to better suit the students and what they want to educate themselves on. And I don't see an issue with that.
Max, thanks for the call. Clay?
Yeah, that's a good, useful, I would say, diagnostic function of it. Indeed, that departments, colleges, and the entire university could adjust if it receives feedback such as that. I would say that as faculty, we are always evaluated based on student evaluations for each class we take. And we do take this very seriously. And so certainly in the open-ended questions on student evaluations here at the University of Florida, students would have that freedom to say, you know, this professor only espouses, you know, leftist liberal ideologies or only espouses conservative ideologies. And I could vouch for it that, you know, department heads would then go back and talk to that at the annual evaluation, which we get in writing. But you can also meet with your department head. And if the department chair were worried about that, would say to that professor, hey, you know, there's a perception, not just among one or two students, but let's say five or six or dozen. And that kind of suggests to me, you know, maybe you should strike a better idea. So we do get feedback, and we would get feedback from students already on those issues. So that is important if it's used as a diagnostic measure so the professors can better calibrate their teaching.
Clay, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Clay Calvert is professor of law and Breckner Eminent Scholar in Mass Communication and director of the Marion B. Breckner First Amendment Project at the University of Florida. We talked to him today about Florida's new law requiring public universities to assess what supporters call viewpoint diversity among students and faculty.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, President Biden visited La Crosse this week to talk about his administration's infrastructure plan. We talked to Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to learn more about Biden's trip and other news out of the nation's capital.
According to the Alzheimer's Association, roughly 6 million people live with the disease today, and they're expecting that number to double in the next 30 years. We'll talk to an Alzheimer's researcher about how we could take steps to hopefully prevent the disease.
And tomorrow is Food Friday. We'll talk about summer produce.
That and a lot more of Food Friday and more coming up tomorrow on this week's edition of Central Time. More than 40 years ago today, a new piece of equipment was sold for the first time, and it changed the way we listen to music.
On July 1st, 1979, Sony's Walkman went on sale. It provided portable, studio-quality music, for the most part, for consumers in a way that wasn't really available until then. It cost about $150 then, which, for those of you interested, would have been about $550 today.
I know by the late 80s, I possessed a Walkman. You know, this is the audio cassettes here. Which is a whole another set of memories. I remember bringing the Walkman to band camp, and I think I lost my Clash cassette there. Were you around early enough for cassette Walkman?
I did. I had a cassette Walkman. That was the only way I could listen to my one Janet Jackson tape that I've actually talked with you about before.
Right.
So this is a fun comparison. But it didn't last very long because I then got a Discman later.
I also remember listening to The Focus, Hocus Pocus, if anybody remembers that rock song featuring yodeling. Yeah, I had a CD one too. I got to say, the cassette was better because with the CD one, it was really, I don't know, touchy. You move a little bit and it skips the CD again and again. Did you have that problem?
Oh, yeah. That's why I never understood how anyone would run outside with a CD player. It would always baffle me to see them running around with it in their hands. It just didn't seem worth it.
Technology news you can use. This is Central Time.